He did. In a letter to his friend Ned Stevens at age 14, he writes, "I wish there was a war." 3. For many in this country, joining the armed services is still seen as a path to security. 'Twas ever thus. 4. I wanted this to sound chaotic, and I often cited to Lacamoire the background vocals in Pharoah Monch's Simon Says. It sounds like a million dudes in a basement. I love that sound. 5. My first part in high school was as the Pirate King in the Pirates of Penzance. It was going to sneak in one way or another. I also think my rhyme for general is better than theirs, mineral. All props to Gilbert and Sullivan, Kings of Light Patter. 6. My elementary school had mandatory chess class from K through 4th grade. I'm still not very good at the game, but I know my way around a chess metaphor. 7. Hamilton and Mulligan really did go on cannon-stealing adventures together. 8. This is a direct quote from Washington in a rare temper tantrum. 9. Burr showed valor as a soldier in his own right and took part in expeditions against the British. He worked for Washington for a few weeks and that's about it. We don't know why they parted. So I made this scene up. 10. My first draft of this line read, "I don't mean to brag, but my dad was the president of Princeton, so..." It was funny, but too snotty. I wanted Washington to not trust Burr on a chemical level, the way only really wise people, dogs, and kids can read people on first meeting. 11. This used to read, "I came to be a soldier, not a secretary." The revision reflects Hamilton's inability to contain his anger. Papi, Washington's only trying to figure out what's wrong. Be easy. 12. Real talk from Washington. Nothing to add, except if present-day me could talk to adolescent me, this is probably what I'd say. 13. I rewrote this line late in the process. Tommy and I wanted to pinpoint the moment when Hamilton puts away dreams of martyrdom to rise in a different way. Not that he still doesn't harbor martyrdom fantasies. Keep reading. A Winter's Ball. 1. Religion is like chess for me. I grew up learning it, and it came in awfully handy as a shared reference for our characters. 2. This is most likely a tale spread by John Adams later in life, but I like Hamilton owning it. At this point in the story, he is at peak cockiness. 3. Here's an example of internal assonance strengthening a punchline. We've got the rhyme at the end, "rich son with which one," but you're scarcely aware of the agreement between sister and if burr in the middle of the sentence. Helpless. 1. Helpless was my second attempt at a song for this moment. I wrote a tune covering the same events called "This One's Mine." I played it for my wife and she made a face. "What?" "Nothing, it's good, but it doesn't feel like it's the final thing." "What do you mean?" "I don't know, it just doesn't feel like you're done." I stewed, I cursed, I stalked around the apartment. And a few hours later I wrote this. She was right. 2. In the original tune, Eliza's opening line was, "I have never been the pretty one, or the funny one, or the witty one. I stayed on the side." This was obviously selling Eliza way too short. She's all those things. But in her opening sentence, I wanted her to establish that she is not the center of the party. That's Angelica's gig. I took the structure of the discarded sentence and used it later for Angelica to far better effect. So I'm the oldest and the wittiest and the gossip in New York City is insidious. 3. All that survives of this one's mine. 4. Several contemporary letters describe Hamilton's eyes. Apparently they were really something. 5. This dialogue is important because we're going to visit it twice. Once from Eliza's perspective and once from Angelica's perspective. I thought a lot about Maria and Tony's dialogue in West Side Story when they first meet. You have 8 lines to encapsulate love at first sight. Go. The challenge here is the same. 6. This is based on a real letter Angelica sent Eliza. She was being as playful as she is here. 7. This is just a note to say I wish you could hear the insane things Sidney Harcourt, who originated the role of Pa Schuyler, and I say to each other upstage in this scene. 8. And here comes Hamilton, anti-bragging. In reality, before their marriage, Hamilton wrote a heartbreaking letter trying to shatter any romantic notions Eliza might have about marrying a penniless man. At the same time, he's bragging about his top-notch brain. This swagger, built on a bedrock of total insecurity, is the contradiction that is our Hamilton. 9. And here's where we prove that my wife was right, and this one's mine was never going to be the right approach for this moment. By wrapping the song around the word helpless, we encapsulate several things. The giddy helplessness of falling in love, but also Hamilton's fear of helplessness, and his identification of helplessness in the first woman he ever knew, his mother. It's a weak point for him. It's kryptonite. And it'll come back in the form of another character in Act Two. Stay tuned. Satisfied. 1. This is the most ambitious tune in this show, and that's saying a lot. It was always a wedding toast, originally entitled, Can I Say Something? I made several starts and stops on this thing, never really satisfied, with the musical feeling. The answer came in a song I'd already written. About 2 years prior, I'd written some music for Karen Olivo for a project that never saw the light of day. She'd written some beautiful, unrequited love lyrics, which I'd adapted into a pretty, haunting, and cool dance tune. It popped up in my shuffle, and I, like Angelica upon meeting Hamilton, realized it was everything I ever wanted in that moment. I frantically called Karen and said, "Hey, remember that tune I wrote you? I kind of need it back. I won't use any of your lyrics, but I need that music, and you're not using it anyway, so please?" There was a pause, and she said,
"Yeah, dude, it's your music."
So Angelica's haunting arpeggio in Satisfied owes a debt to Karen Olivo. She helped bring it into the world. 2. There's no reason this should be funny, except Anthony Ramos says it all the time, so I just had him say it, and it is funny. 3. Satisfied, like helpless, allows us to twist several meanings from it. There's all manner of satisfaction, sexual, emotional, financial. It's also a code word used in dueling, to demand satisfaction. It's also onomatopoetic. It feels like it sounds, satisfying to sing. We wring every last bit from it. 4. This is the genius of choreographer Andy Blankenbuehler, who did the math on how far back we'd have to rewind the scene. We don't just cover helpless. By necessity, we rewind all the way to A Winter's Ball, because Angelica meets Hamilton first, and Andy stages that in pantomime here. I'm getting a headache just thinking about planning it. 5. This exchange, like the 6 lines of dialogue, needs to carry everything in a super compact amount of time. It's when the multiple meanings of satisfied will come in the handiest. Hamilton goes full Jordan Catalano here. 6. I wrote this whole verse in my trailer in one frenzied burst between scenes of the little scene, little-loved NBC show Do No Harm, wherein I played scientist Dr. Ruben Marcato. It was a dream job. We shot on location in Philadelphia, a perfect place to research Hamilton. I was number 5 on the call sheet, which meant I only worked 2 to 3 days a week, and I was a short Amtrak ride from home. I also made friends with Steve Pasquale, Sam Levine, Felicia Rashad, Rudy Gedmintas, Michael Esper, wonderful actors all. I consider Do No Harm an ill-fated show, but also my Hamilton, Philadelphia residency. 7. The structure of this song is exactly the form of the personal literary essay I learned in 8th grade English. Introduction, statement of thesis, 3 proofs, conclusion. Here come the 3 proofs. 8. This scene, when broken up because of the rewind, now takes on more meaning. When the scene ends here, we see how into Angelica Hamilton is.
Lead the way.
9. Okay, so Philip Schuyler really had loads of sons. I conveniently forgot that while I was writing this in service of a larger point. Angelica is a world-class intellect in a world that does not allow her to flex it. 10.
Oof. Trying to out-Eponine Eponine up in this piece.
11. Funny thing about saying a word a lot, it starts to feel the opposite of what it means. With the world singing, be satisfied, without the first half of the sentence, it feels like a perverse, tragic mantra. The Story of Tonight, reprise. 1. I wanted to hear this tune again. This is the tune of brotherhood among these friends, but it can also encapsulate rowdiness and the lewd roast that occurs. 2. Tommy Kail and I always describe this scene as when your hometown friends are at the party with your college friends. 3. This was the way into Burr. I knew he and Hamilton circled each other all their lives. I knew they went from friends to frenemies to foes. But it wasn't till I read this detail online that Theodosia was married to a British officer when Aaron Burr met her, and he waited until she was available, that the character of Burr came free in my imagination. Imagine Hamilton waiting for anything.
That's when I realized our task was to dramatize not two ideological opposites, but a fundamental difference in temperament. No easy task, but that was the task. Wait for it. 1. Jonathan Edwards, writer of Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. 2. Just a note to say that I love how Hymns Won't Teach Ya agrees with Brimstone Preacher. Super subliminal but effective. I actually wrote this verse first and swapped it with the Theodosia verse after taking a step back. 3. I often write loops. I'll make 8 or 16 bars of music I think I like, and I sing over it until it feels true. This is how Wait For It was born. At this point in my life, I was carrying around both an iPod and a phone. I'm grateful for this in retrospect, because the entire chorus came in one ridiculous rush as I listened to the music on a loop on a crowded A train to a friend's birthday party in Williamsburg. I lived at the top of the A train at the time, so that meant taking the A from 207th Street to 14th Street, then the L into Brooklyn. I don't know how to describe the feeling. It did not exist one moment, and then there it was, coursing through my head. Death doesn't discriminate. I got out of the train in Williamsburg and began singing into the voice memo function in my iPod from the loop I was listening to in my phone. This is why I was glad I had them both. I said hi to my friend, wished him happy birthday, had exactly half a beer, and turned around for another hour and a half train ride home, during which I worked out the other verse variations. Music doesn't discriminate when it arrives either. It'll get you on the A train if you're open to it. 4. How do you dramatize stasis, waiting for it? You give the audience a glimpse of the immense self-control that makes it possible. I make you wait even for the words, wait for it. Stay alive. 1. Probably a subconscious nod to all the rig-a-tig-a-tum and crack-o-jacko in West Side Story, though, if I'm being honest, I hear it in Method Man's voice, in that one Wu-Tang skit where they're just talking about how they're going to beat each other up, and bang them shits with a spike bat like blah. 2. I'm playing fast and loose with who gets to be narrator here. I want Hamilton's frustration at being passed over first and foremost, so he gets to tell us this part of the story. 10 Dual Commandments. 1. This song owes a huge debt to Affairs of Honor, the book on dueling by Joanne Freeman. She's also one of the world's foremost Hamilton experts, and her insights and friendship have been indispensable. 2. The entire company narrates this tune. It's the most complex one for our stage manager to call and our soundboard op to track because the narrator keeps changing. I did this because I wanted the audience to understand that dueling was simply a way of life, with its own codes and customs. It was almost never a crime of passion. There were steps and ways out. 3. Burr thought dueling was pointless, by the way. He even prevented one between Hamilton and James Monroe. Until, you know, he didn't. Meet Me Inside. 1. This is one of the only hip-hop songs I know in a 7-8 time signature. It's super hard to sustain, but I like that we break into it right after the duel. It feels chaotic, messy. 2. Jeremy.
A remarkably gracious thing for GW to say. Why have him say it?
Lynn. History has its eyes on him, McCarter. 3. I always love the menace at the end of DMX's Party Up, up in here. Meet me outside. Meet me outside. What's gonna happen outside, DMX? I use that menace here. 4. We're back to 4-4 time here, and this scene is one of my favorites. It's a fully functional scene with two friends at cross purposes. Hamilton doesn't know, or can't internalize, that Washington wants to keep him safe. All he wants is a command. Washington's logic falls on deaf ears, so he keeps trying to get familiar, which only infuriates Hamilton more. This is where watching every episode of The West Wing helps you be a better writer. 5. Doing this scene with Chris is really different every night. We're best friends, and it takes a lot out of us. Sometimes he screams my head off. Other times he can barely look at me. It's always real, though. That would be enough. 1. Very few songs come to me as quickly as the first draft of this song did. Words and music together at the piano, from this point to the end of the tune, in about 45 minutes. There is no historical basis for this song. Eliza needed to say it, so she did. 2. My first draft of this song ended here, but I revisited the tune after writing Burn in Act 2. Tommy and I discussed making Eliza even more active here, not just expressing this sentiment, but asking to be let into Hamilton's internal life. If she's erasing herself from the narrative in Act Two, she needs to be part of it in Act One. I love the way this last section soars. I can't imagine the song without it now. Guns and Ships. 1. This is a weird one. I thought everyone knew this word, yet I don't know where I've heard it. You should have seen the looks on the faces of my collaborators when I brought the song in. It's apparently a super archaic word. I really don't know where I met it, but it was there for me when I needed it. 2. The speed at which Lafayette rhymes here was always meant to be a punchline. Here's Lafayette, the Frenchman, who struggles with the word anarchy in my shot, and he's a speed demon. It's also meant to demonstrate how Lafayette flourished once he was put in command. He goes from being one of Hamilton's friends to a rap god slash military superhero. Doesn't hurt that David is one of the most technically gifted rappers I've ever met, so I knew I could build him tapestries. It was actually his idea to wrap this resilience-brilliance rap in a triplet rhythm, which is perfect. 3. The last line I added to the show. Just one more fast rap for Lafayette, please. 4. In real life, Hamilton and his friends badgered Washington for a command on his behalf. He felt the war was winding to a close and was desperate to see action before its end. We represent that via Lafayette's crazy fast raps. History has its eyes on you. 1. Once again, I'm in Chernow's debt here. Washington is a hard character to bust out of the marble shell in which history has encased him. When I read Chernow's Washington bio and learned about his disastrous first turn with a command, a slaughter that helped trigger the French and Indian War, it unlocked him for me. This is a man whose first brush with fame was humiliation. History had its eyes on him early, and he never forgot it. You can feel him calcify under the weight of it over the course of his life, ever conscious of it. Restraint. It's a lesson Hamilton never really learns. 2. Once I wrote this passage, I knew it would be the key to the whole musical. In the words of Tupac, "This be the realest shit I ever wrote." We strut and fret our hour upon the stage, and how that reverberates is entirely out of our control and entirely in the hands of those who survive us. It's the fundamental truth all our characters, and all of us, share. Yorktown. 1. This just made me laugh. Lafayette and Hamilton, on the verge of the last battle of the war, patting themselves on the back. I never anticipated that the audience response would drown out the next few lines every night. So we added 2 bars just to absorb the reaction. Cheers still drowned them out. So we added 4 bars. Then it felt like we were asking for applause, and they delivered, and it was even worse. We went back to 2 bars, and it is what it is. Why does it get such a delighted response? Because it's true. 2. This is the kind of thing that happens in hip-hop but not so much in musical theater. Breaking the rhyme scheme to highlight a different meaning of the word. Musical theater purists may scoff, but I love that Hamilton's soliloquy here leads him to maturity. He has to put away his martyrdom fantasies because others are counting on him to come home. 3. This seems so counterintuitive, but it's what happened. Leave it to Hamilton to make his men remove their bullets to ensure no one would give away their sneak attack. That's some control freak realness. I can relate. 4. Part of the inspiration for the structure of Yorktown is what I call the Busta Rhymes soft, loud, soft technique. On countless songs, Busta will give you the smoothest, quietest delivery and then full-on scream the next verse. It makes for a delightful tension and release, and it's entirely vocal. Same here. I have everything I wanted, but I can't die today. We're going into battle! Here's what my friends are doing. Hercules Mulligan! Thank you, and God bless you, Busta Rhymes. 5. Lawrence was actually at the Battle of Yorktown. He didn't head down to South Carolina until later. But I didn't have time to explain that, so I moved him down there early. He spent much of the war trying to get approval for a plan that would allow 3,000 black men to fight alongside the rebels for their emancipation and freedom. 6. This Mulligan verse includes the greatest lines from a really long Mulligan verse I wrote for the first draft of my shot. It's much more effective here. 7. Washington, of course, owned hundreds of slaves and did not emancipate them until his death at the end of the century. 8. Per Chernow, this was the name of the tune the British sang as they retreated. I sought out the actual song and it's, well, it's a drinking song. It's sprightly and lively and fun to sing with a pint in your hand, but didn't serve me musically. So I wrote my own melody for it. But God, what a great sentiment for the end of the war and the birth of this moment. What comes next? 1. To paraphrase Ashanti and Ja Rule, the king's not always there when you call, but he's always on time. It was a delight to have him pop up at this key moment. He becomes an audience surrogate in a strange way, robbing the revolution of its inevitability and kicking the tires on it.
So you're going to rule yourselves now. Have you figured out how that works yet? Good luck. It's lonely, thankless work.
2. This is prep for our second act in a real way. It's not hard to make a revolution exciting on stage, but governing, that takes some doing. Dear Theodosia, 1. This song arrived in my life in one of those very strange, momentous weeks. To set the scene, 2011. I was on Thanksgiving vacation with my wife's family in the Dominican Republic. My wife's aunt Isolde, across the sea in Austria, was struggling in the final stages of ALS, so the air was heavy. We dreaded, anticipated the news of her passing even as we attempted to make the best of this vacation. Amidst all this, one day a tiny stray puppy jumped up on my wife's beach chair and nipped at her ankle, with large brown eyes that pleaded, "Get me off this island." Vanessa, a lifelong cat person, switched teams in that moment, and Tobillo, Spanish for ankle, entered our lives for good. We said to ourselves, if she comes back tomorrow, she's ours. She came back the next morning with a little gray sister by her side. That evening, we got the news that Vanessa's aunt passed away on Isolde's birthday. We cried, we held each other, we made travel plans, and we came home to New York with 2 small puppies. Tobillo's sister, the gray dog, lives with a wonderful family in Virginia. It was against the backdrop of this week, full of heartbreak and new discoveries and family life, that I wrote Dear Theodosia. It's the calm in the storm of our show, and it was the calm in the storm of my life in that moment. 2. Be open to accidents as you write. This bridge came about because while playing back a section in Logic Pro, I accidentally looped a random fragment of a measure in the verse. I liked how it sounded so much that I isolated it and wrote these words over it. I am so moved by "My father wasn't around." Maybe because I don't know a set of parents who don't struggle to learn from their own upbringing, invariably making new mistakes of their own. Maybe because my parents worked such long hours on our behalf, and the blessing, curse of that ethic was lots of time on my own as a kid. The time I spent on my own was when I learned to keep my own company and pursue my own creative endeavors. And I wouldn't trade it for anything, despite any loneliness I might have felt at the time. Mostly, the lyric moves me because they're both new fathers, without role models of their own, vowing to do their best. 3. This last section used to be sung by the whole company. But between this, Yorktown, and the upcoming Nonstop, we already had lots of full choral moments, so we simplified it to these 2 men. Tomorrow there'll be more of us. 1. This is the only scene unrepresented on our cast album, precisely for this reason. It's more of a scene than a song. I wanted to save a surprise for those who see the show, and you, hearing this. 2. John Lawrence was the most militant opponent of slavery in this band of brothers. He was also the most reckless in battle, which is saying something in a crew that includes Lafayette and Hamilton. To me, his death is the greatest what-if in American history. A voice for emancipation from a surviving Revolutionary War veteran and a favorite of Washington. We'll never know what could have been. 3. Here's the thing about Hamilton's response. It's more telling when he's quiet than when he has something to say. This was true of the historical Hamilton as well. We have very little written record of his grieving for Lawrence. For a man who had an opinion on everything, for him to hold back betrays genuine, life-changing grief. It is possible that Hamilton and Lawrence were lovers at some point. Hamilton's letters to Lawrence are every bit as flirtatious as his letters to the opposite sex, if not more so. If this is the case, the silence betrays an even more profound loss. Nonstop. 1. They really did set up their law practices in the same hood around the same time. 2. This trial didn't occur until way later, but it's such a perfect way to introduce their post-war lives. 2 lawyers, fundamentally different, meeting up in court, then I moved it up. Love them as a legal dream team, too. 3. Once again, dance hall rhythms for Burr, just as in Wait For It. I wrote much of this song in Nevis, where I did research on Hamilton's life, so my pulse was already on island rhythm time. 4. This sentence sums up how I think most of us feel in the face of Hamilton's remarkable output. Same as Shakespeare or the Beatles. How on earth did you do that with the same 24 hours a day that everyone else gets? 5. 'Twas always true. Pick up the paper today and you can read more about corruption hijinks. There's actually an Albany Museum of Political Corruption. A museum. 6. I wish you could hear my non-miked conversations with Chris Jackson as Washington after this moment. Usually, in character, I say to him, "Well, I meant to talk for an hour, but it just got away from me," as he looks at me with pity. 7. Another great what-if. Historically, we know that Hamilton asked other people to contribute to the Federalist Papers. Madison and John Jay agreed, but Governor Morris declined. I extended that into this fictional scene, wherein Hamilton invites Burr to write. This is the equivalent of asking someone to invest in Pixar just before Toy Story drops. It's plausible, as Burr traveled in the same circles and held similar views to Hamilton, but it gets at the root of their fundamental difference. Burr is not willing to expose himself or his legacy to something this risky. 8. This section was added later. Originally, it ended with the two of them stalking off to their separate quarters, but now Hamilton really challenges Burr at his core. What are you waiting for? It's the more malignant version of, "I will never understand you," from after the wedding. This difference will only escalate over the course of their lives. 9. We're moving chess pieces here. Angelica across the sea. 10. We drop into plain speech here because the facts are so extraordinary that no amount of spin on the ball can make them land any harder. 11. I wish writing were really like the way Andy staged it here. Me in a mania at a desk while a group of people stand around cheering in awe. More realistically, it's me pooping around on Twitter until I get an idea. 12. In the space of 2 lines, Hamilton takes other people's themes and flips them to make his own argument. He throws Eliza's refrain back at her and volleys with Washington's words and melody. He will do anything to get what he's after, and we underscore that melodically here. 13. This all-skate came from tons of trial and error between me, Andy, Tommy, and Lackamore. Take pieces from 5 different puzzles and make something new that sets us sailing into intermission. That's what's at play here. As the guy who gets to play Hamilton, let me also say, it's a hell of a view from the center of it. Act 2. What did I miss? 1. I mean, you can't say Burr didn't warn you Ish was gonna get real. 2. I sometimes say this to Thomas Kail. 3. I can't tell you how thrilled I was when I first saw Kail and Blankenbuehler staging for this moment. Jefferson descending a staircase, with our ensemble scrubbing the floors and getting his bags. It's the paradox of Jefferson made flesh. The writer who articulated liberty so clearly was an active participant in the brutal system of slavery. 4. Figuring out the sound of Thomas Jefferson was a fun challenge. My reasoning: he's a full generation older than Hamilton, and he was absent for much of the fighting of the Revolutionary War, though certainly an architect of some of the founding documents. So I wrote him in a sort of Lambert Hendricks Ross, Gil Scott Heron mode. Jazzy, proto-hip-hop, but not the boom-bap of Hamilton. He has just as much fun with words, but they swing and they sing. 5. Our Sally Hemings shout-out. 6. It's to my regret that Madison's friendship and fallout with Hamilton land firmly in our act break. They wrote the Federalist Papers, but Hamilton's financial plans left war vets who sold their bonds with nothing, and Madison's disgust with this arrangement began their falling out. Madison and Jefferson were in absolute lockstep for much of their relationship, and it worked very well. Jefferson was the charisma, Madison was the wonk. We do our best to convey that quickly here. 7. This was a David improv that made it into the song. Cabinet battle number 1. 1. I was always excited to write these cabinet battles. In fact, I wrote these before many of the other songs in the show. Battle rapping incorporates a lot of elements: moving the crowd, flipping your opponent's insults, verbal prowess. But the stakes are rarely as high as the direction your country takes. I wanted to write battle raps with exactly those stakes in mind. Also, love Washington serving as Mekhi Phifer in 8 Mile here. 2. The fun in writing these debates is, of course, articulating the perspectives of these men in a way that feels contemporary. Jefferson echoes the feelings of many Wall Street critics today when he says, "We create, you just want to move our money around." If I were watching that in a rap battle, I'd nod my head. Jefferson had a way of making himself the man of the people, and I tried to honor that in his battle raps. 3. The first thing I did here was to look up the etymology of diuretic and make sure it existed in this era. Whew. 4. I cannot tell you how cathartic it is to get to express this to Jefferson every night. The audience's reaction is similarly cathartic. 5. I find that people react one of two ways when they're angry. They run hot or they run cold. Most of us run hot. We lose our temper, and our wits often leave us as well. I don't get angry easily. I'm really 5,000 times as mellow as Hamilton. But when I do, I run cold. Time slows down, and the exact right words click into place to destroy what's in front of me. Not proud of it, but it's how I'm wired. I gave this trait to Hamilton, and I think it suits him well. He rhymes the craziest when he is backed into a corner. 6. This line alone makes the student matinees worth it. They lose their minds. 7. Our audiences are of all ages and walks of life, but everyone gets the Grandmaster Flash reference, even if they don't know how they know it. This feels incredible from onstage. 8. Nice bit of symmetry with dying is easy, governing's harder from Act 1. Or as Mario Cuomo put it, you campaign in poetry, you govern in prose. 9. This is familiar in contemporary politics. Take a break. 1. A musical theater composer I love and admire came to a workshop of Hamilton and gave me notes. One of them, Take a Break. It's as well written as your other songs, but you don't need it. I sat with this for a week. I admire this composer very much. But then took the note as a challenge to earn the song's place in the show. It's our only personal check-in with Hamilton's family in a politically heavy second act. I felt like I needed it. So it does exactly what I need it to do without an ounce of fat. Introduces to Philip, let us know that Angelica and Hamilton are still letter flirting, and see that Hamilton's work is driving him to distraction. And out. 2. This is the same melody as the lead-in to 10 Dual Commandments. When you start learning piano, I started at age 6, these are the kinds of pieces you learn. Simple stuff to make you practice scales. Foreshadowing, but also what a 9-year-old would be learning. 3. This used to be a really obscure Macbeth quote. They have tied me to a stake I cannot fly, but bear like I must fight the course. It's from a really short scene in Act 5 where Macbeth kills young Seward. Then Oscar Eustace said, Lynn, I run the Shakespeare Festival and even I don't get this reference. He was correct. I was being willfully esoteric. So I went with one of the greatest hits. But I still like my Act 5 reference better. 4. When people ask me about the most autobiographical scene in the show, I point to this one. There's no history book in which you'll read about Philip doing a recital for Alexander. This came out of me. And looking at it, I see myself, almost painfully, in every character on stage. As Alexander, I relate as a father with an enormous workload. As Eliza, I relate because of the pains I take to slow down and carve out time for my family. But most of all, I'm Philip. I've written something, and I'm proud of it, and I want to show it to the people I love. You didn't expect these notes to turn into my therapy session, did you? 5. And boy, did he get little brothers. 5 of them, actually, and 2 sisters. But if you want to see a musical with 8 kids, go watch The Sound of Music. 6. This took weeks to figure out, but it's based on actual correspondence between Alexander and Angelica. They'd slip commas between words and change the meaning. The passage that inspired this verse was actually in French. Comma sexting. It's a thing. Get into it. 7. And this is why cast albums, all of them, not just mine, are so useful. Maybe 1 in 1,000 people will catch that Angelica's responding with a Lady Macbeth quote, thus referencing Hamilton's Macbeth quote at the top of the song. Also, I first heard Screw Your Courage to the Sticking Place in Beauty and the Beast, not knowing as a child that the great Howard Ashman was quoting Shakespeare. So it's my nod to both. Say no to this. 1. This originally started with an LL Cool J quote from his seminal 80s classic I Need Love. It got a great laugh, but I realized we don't need a laugh here. We really need to focus. 2. Hamilton's the only one who can narrate the song at this point in the story. It happened to him, in secret, and we don't know Mariah or James Reynolds yet. So he does it. It's an all-hands-on-deck approach to the storytelling. The person closest to the action addresses the audience. 3. In real life, Hamilton described the moment this way. Some conversation ensued from which it was quickly apparent that other than pecuniary consolation would be acceptable. Wink, wink. 4. This used to be, how could you do this? Tommy Cale suggested the change, and it's a good one. Hamilton's realization of his own culpability in this situation is far more compelling than blaming Mariah. 5. So imagine you're me, and you get to the end of this song. And you know that there's a really timeless song about the guilt of infidelity in the musical theater canon. Nobody Needs to Know by Jason Robert Brown from his brilliant show The Last 5 Years. And you realize that No is a great twist slash ending to a song about not saying no. What do? You do what I did. Frantically call JRB and ask his permission to quote his work. The Room Where It Happens. 1. My father is a political consultant. These kinds of conversations are very common. Can you believe they named slash honored slash venerated this guy? 2. Sometimes a rhyme leads you to a wonderful, unexpected place. I'm playing with rhymes for Burr, Sir, in the whole show. So I get to Mercer, and I think, who even is Mercer? Google Mercer. General who died during the Revolutionary War. But doesn't he have a street named after him downtown in the village? What was he called before he died? Google? Claremont Street. Wait, this is perfect. In a song about legacy, we can begin with Hamilton and Burr bitching about how the guy who doesn't even survive the war gets a street named after him while they're still alive and hustling. And Burr has legacy on his mind at the top of this song about being on the outside of power and legacy looking in. Thanks, Mercer. 3. Again, we're tipping Burr toward where he needs to get by the end of this song. Hamilton is saying, if I act like you, I can get this deal done. Which leaves Burr asking the unspoken question, why am I, who act like me all the time, not invited to this dinner? 4. The only account we have of this dinner is Jefferson's, so we start the Rashomon sequence with him. 5. I ask the cast to shout any city within the original 13 colonies, but they kind of shout whatever they want. 6. Originally, this section ended with Hamilton, because we'll have the banks, the city's undiminished. Burr, you got more than you gave. Hamilton, checkmate, game finished. And that was the end of the section. On my second go-round of revisions, I seized the opportunity to play out the Hamilton-Burr dynamic inside Burr's mind. It also allowed me to play with the trumpet sample I'd created for the song. That refrain that plays between each section is deliberately treated and processed to sound like an old jazz sample, but it's original. Anyway, this is my favorite part of the show to act as Hamilton. 7. Burr Unbound! This is Oscar Eustace's favorite section, because Burr answers the company's question in the most Burr-like way possible. What do you want? What do you believe in? Burr, I want to be in the room, for the sake of it. 8. Both Lacamoire and Blankenbuehler petitioned me for more time in this section, and thank God they did. Boy, does it bring the number home. 9. I'm perhaps proudest of these 3 couplets in the whole show. They encapsulate everything the number is about, are fully in character, and also speak to something fundamentally true about contemporary politics that I'd never been able to verbalize until these lines showed up. Schuyler defeated. Cabinet battle number 2. 1. This was a natural fit for the second rap battle, because it was the subject in which Hamilton and Jefferson clashed most directly. Much of the poison that came from their respective pens stemmed from this issue, and as Jefferson says, State Department matters are really not in Hamilton's job description. 2. This is a famous line from Biggie's classic song Juicy. David, the first time he got the lyric, it's so hard not to say nigga at the end of this sentence. I'm fighting muscle memory. 3. Originally, Hamilton's argument was as long as Jefferson's, but I realized I wasn't going to top this punchline. Also, Washington cutting him off and agreeing with him leads us nicely into the next song. Hamilton is winning without trying, because he and Washington are in lockstep on this issue. 4. This line gets a really wild card reaction every night, depending on the audience. Sometimes nothing. Sometimes applause. Once, a profound, oh shit. We still recognize ourselves in this one. 5. Originally, this was an exchange about Jefferson and Hamilton's mutual friend Angelica. Jefferson met her in Paris. It didn't serve our transition into the next song, but it was definitely soapy and fun. Hamilton, she's never mentioned you. Jefferson, she's not the type who shares, but since you're so interested in foreign affairs.
Ooh.
Washington on your side. One. I'm crazy about the music in this thing. It's this weird swing beat, not really common in hip-hop, and I probably spent more time building it from scratch and Logic than any other song in the show, with the exception of Satisfied. Originally, the song was much longer and had a section where Jefferson, Madison, and Burr spread rumors about Hamilton. But we realized it was more powerful to keep the action to the three of them plotting and scheming, so the gossip section was cut and replaced with the rat-tat-tat back and forth of the second verse. Two. One of my go-to conversational gambits is switching the letters of someone's name. Jeremy McCarter, more like Merrimy Jakarta. It's not funny, but it makes me laugh, and I find my brain is doing it all the time. Anyway, I stumbled on pits of fashion, fits of passion, realized that they'd both work, and worked backwards to earn them. Three. Jefferson may be Hamilton's antagonist, but he's not wrong. Hamilton's plan left veterans who sold their war bonds out in the cold, and at the mercy of those who bought them, knowing the government would buy them back at cost. Four. Madison used to have his own verse, wherein he said, I used to write with him, imbibe with him, and ride with him. I find myself on this side of a sizable divide with him. We used to fight for the right to be left alone, but left alone to his devices, he's a crisis all his own. Ended up cutting everything but these lines as the lead-in to the group verse. Five. This section is so exciting and personal to me because the interplay between these guys captures how we made the show. Good ideas cascading off each other and leading to action. Six. Like I've said before, having David gave me the confidence to write this intricately, knowing I had a ringer to pull it off. This section is very Kendrick Lamar inspired. He's the master of these polysyllabic gems that seem to go off the rails but are so perfect that the music has no choice but to stop and meet him on the other side. Seven. The line at the Public was, it's nice to have something to really oppose. But I like this better. It's more of a riddle. The Pen and the Pad 2. Top left. Well, I always knew what the punchline would be. Top right. King George's logic in this early draft of Guns and Ships is the same logic our country has applied to any number of ill-advised foreign policy misadventures. History spoiler, people almost never greet invading soldiers as liberators. We eventually changed this section because King George's reemergence after the war is such a delightful surprise, we didn't want to have him pop up any earlier. Bottom left. I'm fiddling with the imagery for the end of The Room Where It Happens. This is all good stuff, and it occurs to me that the last four lines, which didn't make the show, are a riff on Just to Get a Rep by Gangstar. Bottom right. I wanted this song to start as simply as a joke. Three guys walk into a bar. It will ease us into the complexity that follows. Top right. I'm working out the clearest way to convey the importance of comma placement and its usage in surreptitious flirting and Take a Break. The notion of comma placement as flirting knocked me out when I first read about it. I had to get it in there. Bottom. I got exactly this far with Burr singing It's Quiet Uptown when it occurred to me that not only is Angelica the only choice to narrate this moment, it completes her arc in the most unexpected, satisfying way possible. For her to bear witness to the lives of Alexander and Eliza is the role she chose and satisfied. She fulfills it here, at their lowest moment. One Last Time. One. Keeping what I loved about One Last Ride while rewriting it as One Last Time was a little like merging a vanishing bar of soap to a new bar of soap. Takes a lot of strength, and I'd like to end the metaphor here now, please. Two. Reading Washington's farewell address, this section jumped out at me. In it, Washington seeks to do exactly what we aim to do with this musical, paint himself as human and capable of mistakes, which makes his ode to the benign influence of good laws under a free government all the more moving. And moving in stereo because they're Hamilton sentiments as well. The music underpinning it is The Story of Tonight, which we have not heard since Lawrence's death. So it evokes a nostalgia for a more idealistic time in the lives of all these men. I know him. One. Bah-ha-ha-ha-ha! King George showed up again! This surprised me, just as it surprised me when the Piragua guy showed up for his reprise in In the Heights, one of the last songs we added for that show. But sometimes a character just will not be denied. To be honest, his reappearance here was probably inspired by the anecdote wherein King George says of Washington's resignation, "If he does that, he will be the greatest man in the world." I love that. 2. I'm just taking it as a given that everyone watched the John Adams miniseries on HBO. The scene between Adams and King George in that film is my favorite scene in the whole series. The Adams Administration. 1. When I cut the contents of Hamilton's angry pamphlet about Adams, I also cut Adams's insults, which had provoked Hamilton in the first place. At this point, our show is moving very quickly, so I had to get in and out fast. 2. Just begin with a burner of an opening sentence, as harsh as Burr's run-on sentences regarding Hamilton. 3. In a workshop reading, this was Hamilton talking smack about Abigail Adams's appearance, something the historical Hamilton never did, but par for the course in hip-hop insults. One look at the audience's cringing reaction and I cut it. No one messes with Abigail Adams. We just won't have it. 4. This is actually my favorite nod to the musical 1776, not the sit-down quote at the end. 5. The wordplay in this is just so much fun. Nuisance, no sense, my level, malevolence. Hamilton's unhinged as hell here, which makes it fun to play. Alas, he's using all his best stuff against a character we never meet, so goodbye fun wordplay. You're doomed to a footnote in this book. 6. A paraphrase of real-life Jefferson, who called Hamilton a host within himself, in a letter to Madison about an unrelated beef. Also, one more thing. This was the site of one of my best typos of all time. You haven't lived till you've seen David read, "As long as he can hold a pen, he's a treat!" We know. 1. The original line here was a Lauryn Hill quote, but I was told that she does not allow her work to be sampled at all. I like the rewrite, because by flipping into Jamaican patois, it becomes an ugly dig at Hamilton's Caribbean origins. 2. This is a super esoteric reference to my favorite podcast, My Brother and Me. In this podcast, the McElroy brothers, Justin, Travis, and Griffin, dispense hilarious, often terrible advice to listeners. Often, one of them will say, "unless," prompting the other two to say, "unless." And then they'll give completely contradictory, equally hilarious advice. It seemed fitting that Hamilton would go full "unless" right before telling his enemies one of his biggest secrets. Thanks, McElroys. Great job. 3. Hamilton is self-sabotaging by telling his enemies way too much. Note, too, that the music under this scene is the same as James Reynolds' letter in Say No to This. 4. This section has some of my favorite internal rhyming in the show, beyond the spent, sent, sent, sent extravaganza. I dropped the music out under consistency because it puts a little highlight on it. Hurricane. 1. The challenge with this song is such a strange one. A moment alone with Hamilton, wherein he thinks about his whole life and then comes to the wrong conclusion about what to do. He equates his success as a writer with success in general and talks himself into writing the Reynolds pamphlet. This was only plausible to me if, in reviewing his life, we saw the cracks in the foundation of his mind. 2. And here's the crack in the foundation. Here's the trauma to end all traumas. Surviving this must have felt like an even worse punishment than death. 3. And here's Burr, singing his theme, but now it's in anticipation of Hamilton's self-sabotage. 4. And here's Team Hamilton and Mariah Reynolds, those who will be most affected by this thing he's writing, trying to remind him of the ramifications of what he's about to do. Their voices in Hamilton's head as well, but they're drowned out. The Reynolds Pamphlet. 1. The beat for the Reynolds pamphlet is actually a reprise of an earlier cut tune called No John Trumbull. It's super contemporary and totally different from anything we've heard, and I love that the music that accompanies the nation's first sex scandal sounds so contemporary and crazy. 2. This is all drawn from the actual Reynolds pamphlet, with some language updated. I took out "with his privity and connivance" and put in "with his knowing consent." 3. What a joy it has been to see this line pop up during presidential election season. It's just catchy and bitchy enough to be the national gaffe theme song. 4. This was originally part of a longer tune titled Congratulations. It came between the Reynolds pamphlet and Burn, but we realized that the audience desperately wanted to see Eliza's reaction. So I folded the best parts of it into the Reynolds pamphlet. I love how different it is from everything else in this section. It contributes to the feeling that the world is crashing. Pathos within celebration within Schadenfreude. 5. Here's where King George gets in on the fun on stage. A late addition by Tommy and Andy that kicks the deliriousness up to 11. Burn. 1. Eliza's response is lost to time. Those letters were burned after Hamilton's death. This gave me enormous freedom, but also gave me a dramatic action. What if Eliza's reaction is to erase her reaction from memory? Writing this song is the first time I introduced the theme of narrative for Eliza, which I then promptly went back and threaded into That Would Be Enough and the finale of the show. 2. Chernow found a letter from Angelica to Eliza that says pretty much this. Blow Us All Away. 1. This song was originally called Your Boy Is Killin' 'Em, a hip-hop-inspired title that felt too on the nose. The beat was the same, though. This is the brightest, happiest music in the show. Happy flutes and rock bass lines, but all slightly dissonant. I'm trying to ratchet up tension and contrast for what will follow. 2. I always thought of this scene as the talk between Salt and Peppa in the song Shoop. And he's coming this way! Ooh! 3. The name of the play George Eaker was watching? The West Indian. Given Hamilton's origin in the West Indies, it's too good not to mention. 4. This was an actual technique in dueling called the delope. It allowed for everyone to show up and prove they were men and go home alive. 5. To go back to Philip's 9-year-old rap here is almost cruel of me, but God, it's effective. Stay Alive, reprise. 1. As a new father, this is the hardest scene to play every night. Not even what's about to follow, but the frenzy of not knowing. 2. This is why I never got good at piano. I was always changing the written melodies. This is tough to get through every night. It's quiet uptown. The election of 1800. 1. There are so many emotional extremes in this show. It's great when you find the line that does the job just so. This is one of those lines. 2. And now, Burr's initial advice to Hamilton is our nation's first campaign slogan in our telling. It's fun to play with how familiar Burr is in his shamelessness here. You can feel the audience relaxing, as if to say, now this looks like our era. 3. For a bizarre period in our contemporary history, this actually mattered to voters. 4. And Burr's transformation is complete. He has thrown caution to the wind. It's fun playing Hamilton's reaction to this every night. This never happened historically, but what would he have made of it? 5. This used to read, and if you were to ask me who I'd prefer, don't vote Burr. I changed it because I thought prefer might tip my hand to the decision. So I ended the line with a word that didn't rhyme with either last name. Your obedient servant. 1. Sometimes there's a perfect reprise so quickly. Burr should be happy. He's ascended to the second highest office in the land. But it's an empty victory. Jefferson has just made clear that while Burr may be vice president, Jefferson trusts him about as far as he can throw him. The room where it happens is the only thing to evoke here. 2. Originally, my lyrics for these letters were super historically accurate, but I could feel us losing the audience. I figured, if they can't speak plainly here, then when? 3. This is my Parks and Recreation homage. Such a Leslie Knope thing to do. 4. This is a fun one to play because Hamilton understands the consequences of not apologizing, yet refuses to back down. That allows me to calibrate the degrees of stubbornness, anger, and regret differently every night. Playing contradictions is fun. Best of Wives and Best of Women. 1. In the musical of my life, after I'm long gone, my wife Vanessa is going to be the one who steps forward as the hero. Vanessa is not particularly fond of musicals. She only likes good ones. She is not effusive in her praise or boastful. But when I looked up from that Chernow book and said, I think this is a hip-hop musical, she didn't laugh or roll her eyes. She just said, that sounds cool. And that was all I needed to get started. As I fell in love with the idea of a love triangle between Eliza, Alexander, and Angelica, she said, "Can you have Angelica rap? That would be cool." I am someone who is so averse to travel that I wrote a whole musical about not wanting to leave my block in Washington Heights. It was Vanessa who booked us trips and time away from New York. You don't get any writing done here because life keeps popping up. Thanks to her, Hamilton was written in Mexico, Spain, Nevis, Sagaponack, St. Croix, Puerto Rico, the Dominican Republic. Long trips where Vanessa would take me there and then leave me alone to write while she explored. She is my first audience, and she's a tough audience, so I know if I impress her, I've cleared the highest possible bar. She'll come home from work and say, "Your King tune was stuck in my head all day. That's probably a good sign." This started out as a note trying to explain how my wife really is the best of wives and best of women, but I'm trying to get at something more important. This show simply doesn't exist without Vanessa. It's a love letter to her. 2. I wept the whole time I wrote this scene. Again, I can't tell you how many times my wife has woken up to me writing. She is the sleepiest. The world was wide enough. 1. Much later in life, Burr read Lawrence Stern's novel Tristram Shandy. The book has a scene wherein somebody catches an annoying fly, but decides not to kill it, saying, "This world surely is wide enough to hold both thee and me." Burr reportedly said, "Had I read Stern more and Voltaire less, I should have known the world was wide enough for Hamilton and me." If he was joking, it was a wicked joke. But sometimes the jokes we choose to tell are the ones in which we reveal ourselves. The notion of the world being wide enough for all of us is a heartbreaker because it's true. So I took out Stern and Voltaire and kept the heartbreaker. 2. This is historically true. It also requires the actor playing Hamilton to wear glasses on and off throughout the show, so the detail doesn't come out of nowhere at the duel. The number of times I've misplaced my glasses offstage. 3. Sometimes Tommy Cale just calls them right. At the end of 2014, we were making our final push in rehearsal before starting Tech at the Public, and I still hadn't written Hamilton's side of the duel. He looked at me and said, "I feel like it's going to be a New Year's baby," which meant he thought that the answer would come to me on my only day off. Well, cut to January 1st, 2015. My infant son is asleep on my chest, my wife asleep, our dog between us on the bed. And as I lay there with only the sound of Sebastian's breathing, I realize that silence is the one thing we haven't done. The whole show. It's been, to borrow from Act One, nonstop. I place Sebastian back in the bed and walk the dog, beginning to put together this final soliloquy. Who lives, who dies, who tells your story? 1. It's unusual to end a musical with somebody other than the protagonist, but I felt like I had permission to end with Eliza after seeing Tony Kushner and Janine Tesori's Caroline or Change. At the end of the show, Caroline's daughter comes forward to tell us how she will work for a better world because of her mother's sacrifices. You can tell that she'll go on to have an incredible life. It made me want to see her musical. 2. The heartbreaking truth is that she did not live to see her husband's biography published. One of her sons finally completed the work, but not until she had passed away. 3. This fact kills me. It's the line that made me cry the hardest in the writing of it. Angelica, near Alexander, but not with him, for eternity. 4. If this were a work of fiction, any screenwriting teacher would say, "Take it out, it's too on the nose." But Eliza's true legacy is in the futures of those children. She was the director of this orphanage for 27 years. The orphanage still exists, in the form of the Graham Wyndham Organization. 5. Again, I'm so grateful that these words showed up for Washington to say way back in Act One. I knew they'd come in handy when we needed them.
This has been a Hachette Audio production of Hamilton, The Revolution. Written by Lin-Manuel Miranda and Jeremy McCarter. Read by Lin-Manuel Miranda and Mariska Hargitay, with an introduction by Jeremy McCarter. Produced and directed by Cheryl Smith. Recorded by Jared O'Connell and Charles McCrory. Sound editing and mastering by Christine M. Farrell. Hamilton is also available in print and digital formats from Grand Central Publishing, a division of Hachette Book Group. For more Hachette Audio productions, visit us at hachetteaudio.com. Thank you for listening. Text copyright 2016 by Lin-Manuel Miranda. Audio production copyright 2016, Hachette Audio, all rights reserved. Hachette Book Group supports the right to free expression and the value of copyright. The purpose of copyright is to encourage writers and artists to produce the creative works that enrich our culture. The duplicating, uploading, and distribution of this audiobook without permission is a theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like permission to use material from the audiobook, other than for review purposes, please contact permissions@hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.